This is the recent interview with Nick Gillespie. I'm Billy Binion, guest hosting for Nick. Today's guest is Sister Helen Prejean, a Catholic nun famous for her activism against the death penalty. In the early 1980s, Prejean met a prisoner on death row, Elmo Patrick Saunier, after an activist asked her to write him a letter. She served as Saunier's spiritual advisor and accompanied him to his death, which inspired her work against capital punishment. Her 1993 book, Dead Man Walking, then inspired a movie starring Sean Penn and Susan Sarandon, who won an Academy Award for her portrayal of Prejean. Jake Heggie and Terrence McNally also created a highly regarded opera of the same name. I spoke with Prejean about growing up in the segregated South, her opposition to the death penalty, how she connects with crime victims, and her response to Christians who still believe capital punishment is just. And now, to the recent interview with Sister Helen Prejean. Sister Helen Prejean, thank you for talking to Reason.
I am very happy to be here because I understand you're not only big into reasoning, but you also have a little music in your life, like opera or classical music.
Wow, you do your research. Yeah, so my first career was I sang in the chorus at an opera company in Virginia after studying music and have always loved music. And they made an opera after you, actually. And I'm sure some of my former opera singer friends are going to absolutely die that we're talking.
Well, it was at the New York Met in September. Man, I mean, they reached 90,000 people. And you know how important music is and drama.
Right.
So opera is the fullest of the arts. Because
I totally agree. It combines the drama, the singing. The dancing, there's usually a ballet corps. I totally agree. So this opera that we're discussing, Dead Man Walking, is based on your best-selling memoir. So in 1984, you were in the Louisiana Death House before you were about to witness your first execution, Patrick Saunier's. And while you were waiting, a guard asked, "What's a nun doing in a place like this?" So 40 years later, almost exactly, how would you answer that question now if he were sitting in front of you?
Well, first of all, you say nun, you say woman, you say person who's seen a lot, come to understand a lot. That's why I love the name of your program and the theme of reasoning, because it's then figuring stuff out. There was the theory of what the death penalty is supposed to be. And then I watch this human being I'd known for 2.5 years strapped into a wooden oak chair and electrocuted to death, and it was called justice, and it seared my soul. And you can't see something like that. And then I began to learn about how it works, and that's why I love this reasoning thing. Like, what are we doing here? Is this accomplishing what they say we're supposed to be doing?
So that guard was surprised, though, that there would be a spiritual advisor in the room there. That's interesting to me.
Texas allows the spiritual advisor. I had to be on the other side of the glass with Pat Saunier, but now they actually allow spiritual advisors to be in the room, as I was on February the 28th with Ivan Cantu in Texas. He asked me to be with him. So what happens to me, Billy, is these people just keep coming to me.
Right.
No, with these requests like, will you be with me when they kill me? And what are you going to say, right? And so I am. I say yes to it. But that was so surreal to be with Ivan Cantu. The two key witnesses in this case had recanted. They were bringing this out that they had lied at his trial. His last words were to the victim's family who come to watch him die, "I didn't kill your son. I didn't kill your daughter. If I had known who did it, I would have helped you." It is so unreal. And when you're immersed in it, and then what you do is you read, you study, you learn. I was just reading Ginsburg's arguments for the first time about gender discrimination before the court. And how do you put your case out there? And how do you take people step by step to understand? There's a theory. And there's reality.
Right.
What's actually happening.
So for people who aren't as familiar with your story, I want to talk a little bit about your journey into counseling people on death row. So in the early 1980s, you start corresponding with a man on death row named Patrick Saunier, who we have mentioned, who was convicted of rape and murder. How did you come to connect with him? And what was that correspondence like?
It was, first of all, you got to understand that I immersed myself with struggling African-American people in New Orleans. I had with other white people a privilege, which is what nuns can be, you know, out in the suburbs. But I awakened to justice and to the struggle of poor people. And that was a deeply held faith thing. That's the gospel of Jesus, very radical. And I had moved into the inner city with African-American people who became my neighbors for the first time in my life. Because when I grew up in the Jim Crow days in Baton Rouge, I only knew black people as our servants. It was Jim Crow. Black people didn't go to school with me. We never mixed with black people socially. And I was with them and I saw the other America. And I saw the suffering of mothers with not enough in welfare and no health care for their children and just all the struggles. And while I was there working at a place called Hope House, one day it was a real casual conversation. When I look back on it, a friend of mine from the Louisiana Coalition on Jails and Prisons had a clipboard, and everybody met that day is asking them to be part of a project. He bumps into me and he goes, "Sister Helen, you want to be a pen pal to somebody on death row?" And he's all poised there with his little clipboard. And I said, "Yeah, I could write some letters." I thought I was only going to be writing letters. I didn't know they were going to kill this guy. I had no idea about criminal justice or law. All while Tim Robbins was writing the screenplay of the movie A Dead Man Walking, he kept saying, "The nun is in over her head." Totally in over my head. And that's how it started. So here was this name, Patrick Sonnier. "Will you write him a letter?" "Yeah, I'll write him a letter." And you know what the problem was, Billy?
What was the problem?
He wrote back. And there was a connection, human connection. If you make a human connection.
Were you not expecting him to write back?
No, I wasn't.
Yeah.
Because the guy who actually gave me his name said, "You know, he's kind of a loner. He doesn't write back. Maybe I ought to give you somebody else." I said, "Give me that guy." Something in me was drawn to that guy. I said, "Give me that guy. Even if he doesn't write me back, I'm going to write to him." And I knew what the essence of my letters was going to be. You are a human being and you got a dignity nobody can take from you. Right. I didn't even know his crime yet, but I know that Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the inalienable right to life every human has. So that's how it started.
So then you end up meeting him in person.
Yeah.
Scary. And what was that? Were you nervous? What was that like?
Very nervous. Very, very nervous, Billy. I walk into the Louisiana State Penitentiary. They have a big green sign: "By stepping onto prison property, you subject yourself to dog sniffing, body circles." Right. So I went, "Can't play the nun card here. They don't give a hoot about it. What am I doing?" And then the guard said, "Here, I'll take you to your man." And I mean, he would walk and there would be these clanging gates behind us. "Woman on the tear, woman on the tear," everybody shrinking back. Then they lock me in a room. "We go get your man." I wait for him. I hear him coming with the guard. I can hear the leg irons scraping on the floor. And then I see him. He was in something as small as a telephone booth with this heavy mesh screen. And I looked at his face. I thought his face was going to be mean. Because if you kill somebody, aren't you mean? I mean, aren't you? And I could not believe how human he was. And he was smiling. He said, "Thank you, sister, for making that long drive." And so we began.
What were your feelings on the death penalty before this?
I had grown. I mean, the traditional Catholic teaching was, you know, under the fifth commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," but exception for the state to be able to keep society safe by executing violent murderers. And I never questioned it. I had no reason to question it. I didn't even know people. And but then once I moved to Hope House, once I began to meet people and saw there were rules, if you were poor, that what happened to poor people was very different from what happened to people with resources, I just began to look into it. And I began to meet human rights lawyers who had taken these cases, and they became my teachers. And then I began to learn. And then that experience of actually being with somebody executed, because, you know, it's a semi-secret ritual. It's behind prison. Very few people ever witness it. And that was it. I was thrown into the fire. I mean, there's this saying in Latin America, what the eye doesn't see, the heart can't feel. And I saw and I felt. And I came out of that. It was the middle of the night, came out, breaking out in this prison vehicle to the gates, friends waiting for me. We had stopped the car because I had to throw up because of what I'd seen. And then that's how I became a witness, was people are never going to see this. They're going to say, well, that was justice. Look what he did. He deserves it. So, yeah. And I was the one who had been there. So I had to be the one to tell the story. And first, I just gave talks. And then I wrote a book, Dead Man Walking.
Dead Man Walking. So there was another death row inmate you counseled during the same period named Robert Lee Willey, who was convicted of raping and murdering an 18-year-old named Faith Hathaway, crimes for which he was unrepentant. Hathaway's parents, Vernon and Elizabeth, ended up becoming activists on the other side of this debate in favor of the death penalty. And so I'm wondering if you can kind of talk about what your relationship with them was like, and how generally you talk with victims who have experienced these, you know, enormous losses while still being true to your position.
Yeah, well, that's a really tough one, Billy, because their pain and their trauma is so great. And I haven't suffered like them. I haven't had somebody kill my child. And so it puts me, I'm off kilter in a way when I'm encountering them, because it's always a kind of guilt I feel. I know what my principles are.
Right.
But with Pat Sonier, I had not reached out to the victim's family. Teenagers were killed, and I regretted that afterwards. One, the father of the boy had said to me, sister, you've just been visiting with those brothers, but you didn't want to come to see us. I had nobody to talk to, and I realized you can't just put victims in this category. So when I took on Robert Lee Willey, because this lawyer, Millard Farmer, got me involved with the case, I went to go see the Harveys just to go visit with them, because I wanted to get to know them and I wanted to hear them, just listen to them. Billy, it was one of the saddest, hardest afternoons of my life. It was in October. I went to their house. There was Faith's picture hanging on the wall. She was young. She was just 18. And this man now that I'm going to be the spiritual advisor to, Robert Willey, is the one who, with a man, Joe Vaccara, raped her and helped kill her. And I'm talking to the parents who are talking about Faith and who are talking about, and you know, it's just such a, it's like a riptide in your soul. I know that the state should not kill Robert Lee Willey, but look at this pain. And then it gets complicated, because what is the state offering the Harveys? What do they offer victims of murder? That you're going to have to wait now. Hope it won't be too long. But what we're going to do for you is we're going to let you sit on the front row and you watch as we kill the one who killed your loved one. And you get to witness that, and that is going to give you closure. And God, it's so contradictory, so morally bankrupt. First of all, the average wait of victims' families from the time a death sentence is given in the United States to execution is 17 years.
Right.
So all these years, their grief is public, the media is at their door. How can they grieve and how can they heal? It's such a... But how do you speak to them? How do you say, well, this is not going to bring it? You don't say anything. You got no words to say to them because you haven't been in that fire like they do. And so what you do is you listen. Tell me about your pain. And what happened with them, with the Harveys, with Vernon and Elizabeth, because I had visited them and listened to them, when I then walk into the pardon board hearing and they see that I'm by Robert Willey's side, they go ballistic. They just go, well, we thought we'd won you over to our side. The movie really captures this in the film, Dead Man Walking.
So does the opera.
And the opera as well, exactly. you know. So anyway, that is, and it's just such a split in your soul. It's so hard. You don't feel virtuous. You don't feel good.
Right.
Oh, you know what you got to do.
So what was that conversation like? I mean, was there an understanding or were they, did you all establish some kind of a relationship? I mean, were they, how did that play out?
We would see each other whenever there was an execution. They are there holding the sign.
Right.
Another murderer getting their due. I'm on the other side. And we began to talk to each other. Sometimes I would visit their house and Vernon would barbecue and he'd pour out a little bit of bourbon for me. It's a Southern thing. We had this kind of love-hate thing going on. And then one time he had heart surgery. And Elizabeth actually called me and said, I'm worried about Vernon. His blood pressure is going down. He's given up the fight. Would you please visit him? I think you definitely will help him get his blood pressure up. And I did. I brought him an apple pie in the hospital and I talked. We had that like love-hate thing going on. But then finally it really broke at the execution of Robert Willie, because I was there as his spiritual advisor and trying to help Robert, who was mad as the dickens that these parents wanted to see him die. He wanted to make a speech and tell them all to go to hell. And he was a tough guy. And there I was. And then after the execution, there's all the media. It was the first time it was really shown national TV. Louisiana was the first state to say, well, the victim's family should be the first ones that have a right to witness execution. So it had got national media. It was Peter Jennings. And they go right to Vernon Harvey. And they say, okay, you got to watch Robert Willie die tonight. How do you feel now? And I still remember him. And he went like this with his thumb. And he said, the son of a bitch died too quick. What they should have done was trap him in. And then at the very 3 seconds, don't pull the switch, send him back to his cell, then bring him back again. And I was standing there in the parking lot outside the gates of Angola prison. And I heard him say these things. And I went, he's going to kill Robert in his mind over and over and over again. But what is he going to do? Now Robert is dead. He's unreachable to him. What does he do with this grief and this trauma and this loss and this hatred, you know? That's when it really came home to me. Wow, it's just, they put the victim's family on a seesaw and tell them everybody's your enemy who's against the death penalty. All these bleeding heart liberals coddling these murderers. They don't care about you. And I'm looking at Louisiana. We haven't executed anybody since 2002. The fire's kind of gone out of it to kill people. I mean, we can see that happening. But yet, we spend at least 15 million every year just to keep the death penalty in place. And all that resources could be going to victims' families. 70% of them that lose a child get divorced. They need counseling. They lose their jobs. They can't focus. They need a lot of help. And instead, we put all those millions of dollars into killing a person instead of putting it into healing and helping them in their lives, really helping them.
Is it hard, you know, essentially having a career sticking up for people that are deeply, deeply unpopular?
Well, that's one way of framing it, of course. And you use the word career. I'm a Catholic nun. It comes
or,
out.
Life's work.
Life's work. No, fine. We ain't going to quibble over words. An unpopularity comes with the territory, because what people want to do is focus all their hatred on this person and identify them completely with the worst act of their life and saying we're justified in killing them. Everybody wants to be a good person. Even a warden standing there officiating. They were all very polite to me in Texas when I went for Ivan's execution. It comes with the territory, but we do see movement. I have seen talking to thousands of people in audiences across this country that when you can bring them close to what's involved with this and what it entails, And this includes the dialogue with the Catholic Church, because I was in dialogue with two popes about it. How can you say does the Catholic Church only uphold the dignity of innocent life? Well, what about the guilty? And so here's a man strapped down, totally defenseless and deliberately killed, when we have an alternative. We have a way to keep society safe. And that's what prisons are for.
Right. Where
you say there's dignity in this. And I found that when it's through story, Billy, which is why the opera is strong, which is why the movie's strong, which is why the book, because story is more comprehensive than debate and just trying to deal with facts and statistics. It brings you into a human environment. And I know that's my job, is to be able to bring people. I had the best editor at Random House when I wrote Dead Man Walking, came out in 93. I'd never written a book before. And when he got the first draft, he said, "You're a good writer, but nobody's going to read your book. You wait far too long before you really get into the pain of the victim suffering and what happened. Two teenage kids were shot in the back of the head by Pat Sonier and his brother. And these families, these mothers and fathers, you wait. It's way back in the book. Nobody's going to read your book. So if you don't talk about the killings, the horror of them, and your own outrage in the first 10 pages, nobody's going to read this book. And then your job, bring them into the killing, bring them into the outrage, which you yourself feel. And then you got to walk that thin line of taking them finally into the execution. That's just the way the opera is set up as well. And let them see for themselves. Because when I learned this, I learned the power of a book, because when people are reading, they're using their imagination, and it's a very intimate process. And you take them there. So, boy, you're giving them the details. Here I am walking with him. Here I am with my hand on his shoulder. Here he is saying to me, "Sister, just pray God holds up my legs while I make this walk." And you take them there, and then you don't preach at them. Then you don't give them 14 arguments why they need to be against the death penalty. Just bring them there.
Mm. Well, they were definitely wrong about no one reading the book. So there are a few really big death penalty cases in the news right now. We're recording this in October. I'm not exactly sure when this will air, but one that will still be in the news, I assume, is that of Richard Glossop's. A man whose case you're deeply familiar with. He was convicted of 1997 murder of his boss, Barry Van Treese. And what is
the mastermind, the guy who killed his boss, admitted it. It's very complex.
It's this elaborate murder for hire scheme for which there is essentially no hard evidence to substantiate. He has eaten his last meal three times. And what I think is most kind of stunning about this case is that the Oklahoma Attorney General, Gettner Drummond, who is a conservative Republican, told the parole board it was imperative that Glossop not be executed, which was the first time, I believe, in state history an attorney general has done that. The Supreme Court eventually stepped in, but prior to that, the parole board had declined to act, and you know, the state appeals courts had not ruled in Glossop's favor. So I'm just wondering what you think it says about our system that's what it has had to come to, that this man has eaten his, you know, last meal three times. As I said, a conservative Republican attorney general is telling the parole board this is not in the interest of justice. But it really came down to the wire. What does that say?
Yeah, really. And many people have come down to the wire like that and then been killed because the Supreme Court refuses to take the case. Now, what made the Supreme Court take this case? It is so unusual for the highest ranking prosecutor in the state, the attorney general himself, to say, and entered into the pleading with the Supreme Court along with the defense, the state made errors in this case. It was not a fair trial. And so it needs to be sent back for a new trial. That is so unusual. That's why the Supreme Court is a killer court. They just refuse to grant cert to hear cases. All the death, it's just like WD-40 has been put on the rails and they go right through. But the attorney general of the state is himself saying we in the state made a mistake, and we ask you, the highest court in the land, to do justice. That's why it got a hearing. So we're waiting on that. The very beginning of Richard's story, see, I'm sitting here in my little living room. Right behind me, right through there, is the kitchen. And it was a phone call early in January 2015. And the voice on the other end of that phone was this man named Richard Glossop, who had found out about me. Hmm. And here was this voice, still, I apologize. I should have asked your permission. He has a sweet voice. He just said, but I put you down to be with me because I think they really are going to kill me here. Would you be with me? So I said, yes, I'll be with you. Got into bed that night, Billy. And from all I knew about the case, I'd already written a book, The Death of Innocence, about people that executed, but they had all these questions. And so I knew enough.
Right.
Bolt awake, 2 o'clock in the morning, going, I can't just go be with that guy that the state of Oklahoma's going to kill. I think he's innocent. I got to get active. What do I do? What do you do? It's the last minute. He's supposed to be killed in a couple of weeks. What chance do you have, right? So you get active. So I called Susan Sarandon. I knew he needed to start getting it out on the media. And I called my contacts with the Vatican. Let's see if we can get Pope Francis in there to raise his voice as well. Then I called.
What a contact book you have.
What?
What a contact book you have, calling Susan Sarandon and the Pope.
Well, if you look under the P's, we got Prejean, Sean Penn, Pope. Well, that's, but a lot of just good, ordinary people like us, Billy, in there, of course. So we just started acting, and I went down to Oklahoma, got a hold of that scrappy little Oklahoma Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. They're getting run over every week with these deaths. And call him up and say, let's have a press conference. And here was the first thing I learned from Amnesty International. The first thing you do is you create doubt. This seems signed, sealed, and delivered. Richard actually had 2 trials. You know, he's been found guilty. It's been through the appeals courts. He's got to be guilty. And you create doubt. And it all hinged his case on the word of a man named Justin Sneed, who, he's a meth, heavy, heavy meth addict. And he confessed to the police that he had killed Barry Vantrese, owner of the motel, killed him with a baseball bat because he was going in to get money for his meth, going to steal from him. And so looks like that case is just going to proceed that way. Here's the one who did the killing. But the detectives in the prosecutor's office start injecting over to Justin Sneed, but look, we think you didn't do this alone. Richard Glossop put you up to it, right? And they introduced the idea to Justin, and he's going to throw you under the bus. You're going to get the death penalty. So he's threatened with the death penalty. And then he said, yeah, Richard put me up. It's only his word.
Right.
Didn't, only later did they get these videos of how the detectives were feeding him this stuff.
Right. Do you think, of course, it's impossible to say, but do you think that Richard Glossop will see justice?
You know what? I think there's a chance he will. It's going to be prolonged.
Right.
If the Supreme Court does the right thing, they remand the case and just say he needs a new trial. They might do a delaying tactic of, well, let's have an evidentiary hearing about this prosecutorial misconduct. We want to give the prosecutor a chance to save his good reputation, all that. And that may delay it some. But I do think eventually, Richard, of all the people I've been with, I've never helped save anybody's life. They've all died, 8 of them. I think Richard has a chance.
So there was another case in the news recently about a guy named Marcellus Williams, who was convicted of murder in Missouri. And there was a big push around his innocence as well, although I will be candid in that I was less convinced of it than
Was it about innocence or was it about his mental capacity that was not taken to account?
There was a big push around him potentially being innocent. But the question I was going to ask you is that, even if he were guilty, should that matter in talking about, you know, the whether or not the death penalty is a just response?
Yeah, right. That's the deeper question, see. What are we doing in trusting over to state government? Look at this whole process. They're going to set the criteria by which you're going to choose, and they have an impossible criteria. They said you don't give the death penalty for ordinary murders. You only give it for the worst of the worst.
Right.
Who does Sam Hill knows who the worst of the worst is? Well, my mother was killed. My mother. I don't have another mother. Isn't that the worst of the worst? How do you determine worst of the worst out of all? Oh, well, this is what we call a garden variety ordinary murder. No, nobody knows how to do that. So in the Gregg decision, 1976, Supreme Court put the death penalty back into the United States. The criteria they set is we got to have more guidelines for juries. You only go for the worst of the worst, and they don't define what that is. You don't leave that up. And the other thing they did, and this is really a bad thing. They left the discretion whether or not to seek death in the hands of a single individual. And it's that DA that decides if they're going to go for death or not. They have huge discretion. How did Trump, before he left office, in the last 6 weeks, kill 13 people? He made a decision because he had the power, the discretionary power to enact it. And they are given this power. And we are right now in a second wave of killing in the deep South states. Look at it. In the ex-slave states have done over 70% of the executions. And all these waves of killings in Missouri, in Oklahoma, in Texas, it's killed over 500. You know, you look at the states, Alabama, they were all former slave states. And they're the big ones. And so the politicians in office, our governor right now in Louisiana, Jeff Landry, has designated 12 people he wants to kill. And he's brought back the electric chair. He hates fighting all these legalities about what are approved drugs for lethal injection. And he's got the legislature with him. Okay, so he's brought back the electric chair and he's building a chamber that they can use nitrogen gas. And he is out to kill people. That is what he is out to do. And a lot of them have been in the pipeline, put there in the 80s. Their appeals are over now. There's nothing to save them in the courts. And so you know who the heroes are, Billy? It's these appeals lawyers in the trenches fighting hand to hand with this governor and these prosecutors trying to get these people killed, and they're trying to save their lives.
You're in Louisiana. Would you ever meet with Jeff Landry?
Governors usually don't meet with me unless they're ready to do something. Right. If I could say it that way.
So here's a question. Based on what you were just saying, if there were a way to ensure that no innocent people were ever executed, that it was meted out completely without any bias, I'm granted, I just, you know, accept my
I'm stretching.
Right. That it didn't discriminate based on class or anything like that. Could you support it then?
Of course not. It's the act itself. Because the essence of torture is an extreme mental or physical assault on someone. And here's a key thing, who's been rendered defenseless. And you take an alive human being from that cell, and you force them into a chair or into a gurney, and you deliberately kill them. That is what is against the dignity of human and against our own best souls. There's no way. And then everything that you just threw in there, that it was a fair trial and all, remember what the criteria were, worst of the worst, and you can't help but get into race. You can't help it. Because overwhelmingly, it's when white people are killed, because white people have more status. When people of color are killed, often there's not even an investigation. You got to care about who got killed. You have to see worth in their life. And it's the race of the victim that's the big telling thing of racial discrimination in the application of the death penalty. It's almost always when white people are killed.
I want to talk to you about your faith, because it is obviously something that informs everything you do. There are a lot of Christians who do support the death penalty. I think it's 66% of Protestants and 58% of Catholics was the latest poll I read. I'm sure you're also well aware that people often cite a verse in Romans where Paul says, if you do wrong, be afraid, because rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. So I'm wondering how you respond to those Christians who say that the death penalty is not only, it's not an injustice, but it's a necessity.
Oh, yeah. And it's blessed by God.
So how do you respond to that?
Yeah, well, I'm heavy respondent to that. In the book Death of Innocence, I take on Justice Scalia, who, when he was on the court, Catholic, made those precise arguments and quoted that very thing from St. Paul, be afraid. And God has invested the state with God's authority to do wrath on evildoers. And those are all key aspects of it. God wants to do wrath. That bloody somebody kill somebody, God wants to have him kill. Quoting the authority of God, which is more a theocracy than it is a democracy, to quote the authority of God, because faith gets into a realm. The name of your program is reasoning. And we know that faith is in another realm. It's not just pure logic. It's in another realm. But we have souls. We have morality. We have conscience. And that's what we have to appeal to. And that's what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights gives a road. Everybody, faith or no faith, can go down. But finally, it's that essential dignity of the human person. And the way they put it, and this is what I believe in my own faith. Jesus said, love your enemy. Jesus didn't say, execute the hell out of your enemy. He said, love your enemy. What are you talking about? How am I going to love an enemy? And I learned this from a victim's family, Lloyd LeBlanc, whose son David was killed by Pat and his brother. And he said he was filled with anger. He wanted to just kill with his own bare hands. But the anger was eating him alive. And he kept praying, because he's a good Catholic man. And he kept praying, God, this is destroying me. It was his own anger was consuming him. And then when he told me about this journey into this, he put his hand out like that, and this at one point, like, stop. And he said, they killed my boy, but I'm not going to let them kill me. And he reached the deepest part of his soul that he would not be destroyed by anger. And so when you look at not just Jesus, but the deepest spiritual traditions that we have, it's always about don't be overcome by your enemy so that it destroys you, but that you move on with your life and have a positive, loving life. And that's what it means. So the deepest thing of faith, Jesus is very radical. Love your enemy. You've heard it said, an eye for an eye, but I say to you, you know, but nobody wants to quote those words of Jesus. They just, and this is the problem of a selective religious belief where you can go to the Bible and selectively quote whatever quote you want, because it's all in there. My faith is that the deepest love has got to be not just for those of us who are beautiful and lovely and loving people themselves, but those that others consider disposable human waste. And the gift in my life is that I've been able to go to those places and meet those people, and I've learned a crucial, really important life lesson, that everybody's worth more than the worst thing they've ever done in their life, Billy, and that everybody can be more. One time, the warden at Angola Prison, Louisiana State Penitentiary, told me, you know who generally makes the best trustees at this prison? This is 5,000 men, most of whom, a lot of whom have life sentences. He said, people in for murder. Most people here who committed murder didn't know when they woke up that morning they were going to commit murder. They got in a fight with somebody in a bar. They had this. And they get here, they have the discipline of prison, they begin to read books, they get a little education, they learn how to talk without hitting people first. They might hit them third, but they grow as human beings. And then we got to kill them anyway with the death penalty. And human beings change. Mm.
So how does your pro-life ethic inform some of your other views? Is it something that kind of, is it the tie that binds? How does it affect the way you look at the world more generally on some of the other issues of the day, like abortion and war and those sorts of things?
Well, that's a great question because it's at the heart of things. Everybody should be given a chance at life. And so when we look at the vulnerable people, because see, especially, Billy, when you come out of privilege, like I presume you do and I know I do, there are people, look at what they're born into, look what they have against the vulnerable ones of society, the homeless ones. And surely we do have to respect life of the unborn, that children have a chance. But we can't do that without also looking at the rights and respect for the woman who bears the child and who's going to raise the child. And often where's the father and the woman's alone. You got to weigh those things. You have to weigh everything when you look at morality and being pro-life. And what does it mean to be pro-life when you're for the death penalty and you spended millions to get one person killed instead of helping the victim's family? And what does it mean to be pro-life, but then after the child's born, you're not in there working for legislation for that child to be able to get enough food or, you know, early education? We know that whatever happens to a child in education by the third grade marks them for life. What about all those pro-life issues about people being human beings, the homeless? All of them are connected. And I feel just really lucky and blessed to be alive, especially be alive in my mind. You know why I responded to you? Because you called it reasoning. We got to make sense of things.
That's the name of our publication. I hope appropriately so.
Yes, very much so. Because you got to make sense of things.
Right.
So boy, that has led me to read more than I've ever read, meet some of the best lawyers to what are the issues? How do we do this? And how do we talk to the people? That's my job.
Right. I appreciate that you do have this principle that you apply very consistently, this pro-life ethic, whether it is talking about abortion or war or, you know, helping the vulnerable people among us, like you say. But that puts you in a pretty politically homeless place these days. You know,
no.
You don't think so?
No, I've been with too many audiences. I've been with too many people who give them a chance.
Well, I just mean in the context of our very like tribal political landscape, you know, Republicans versus Democrats or whatever.
You don't overdo that too much.
Well, reason is supposed to be a corrective to that. So I agree with you that that's an issue, but I'm wondering how you navigate kind of, you know, not fitting into a box as you go and talk to people. Because, I mean, I'm assuming you talk to legislators and lawmakers and you don't fit neatly into a box when it comes to our black and white politics. So what is that?
Neither do you, sir. And
I agree.
One of the things you do is a podcast like this.
I agree.
We talk to each other and we get into the people. That's what you do. Ordinary people who know some stuff and have learned some stuff. You do it. You share it with people. We're about to have the graphic Dead Man Walking come out in 2025. It's illustrated. And boy, are we going to get it in the hands of high school students, college students. And you keep it going. When you have... I mean, Martin Luther King said it best, you know, about the arc of the universe is long and it bends toward justice. When you discovered something really important like I have, that all human life has value and we can't be putting the state in charge of killing people, and you can go to people with a story and talk to them, that's outside of tribal boxes.
Right. It is. In your latest memoir, you write that, quote, looking down the road, I hope that the recognition by the church of the inviolable dignity of every human person, even criminals, will become a guiding moral principle for the church to rethink its attitudes, teachings, and policies on women and LGBTQ persons. What did you mean by that?
Well, just what it says. I mean,
policies and attitudes do you
have? Well, like, I mean, look, I just saw this film called Conclave about the election of a pope and the issues that were all involved in it and so forth. The women in it are all nuns fixing the food for the men. And I got to have a direct dialogue with Pope Francis, and I said, women are not in there with decision-making. And if you have an all-male decision-making church, you absent the experience of women, the wisdom of women, until we build that in. And I said, I've preached all over this country and before the United Nations, and I'm not allowed to preach in my own Catholic church simply because I'm a woman. We got to change that. And you can see it. You can see the way as the culture begins to change, and then the church rises with it. The heart of the dialogue that I had with Pope John Paul, who, as you know, came before Francis, was I meet a lot of Catholics, and they say they're pro-life. But when you talk to them, they say they're pro-life for innocent life, but not for people who are guilty of crimes. Where is the dignity, as I just said to you earlier, in taking an alive human being and strap them down and render them defenseless and kill them when you have an alternative? That pro-life thing that you touched on there was at the essence of that conversation. Does the Catholic Church only uphold the dignity of innocent life? What about the guilty? Where's Jesus in this? What do we stand for? And that Pope, John Paul, was the first one to start making a change, saying publicly about the death penalty is a pro-life issue. And then Pope Francis in 2018 changed the official teaching of the Catholic Catechism. But Billy, that was 1,500 years of dialogue. Takes a while. But I believe in dialogue, and I believe that people can change and people get it.
So I want to talk a little bit about you personally. You entered a convent in the 1950s when life in a religious order was radically different. You weren't really allowed to make friends. You weren't really allowed to speak very much. Once you were so keen on keeping your eyes in meditation that while walking down the hall, you knocked another nun over, which I'm pretty sure I laughed out loud at that description. And some nuns were so keen on depriving themselves of just like pleasure from eating food that they would raise a leg under the table so they could distract themselves.
And you've got all the good, gritty parts.
I do. I mean, I just thought all these examples were so interesting. And I'm wondering, how did that lack of freedom during that kind of pivotal part of your life affect the way that you see liberty and freedom and autonomy now?
Well, you see, the way faith and the church and religious life was in the 50s before Vatican II, you have to understand that Vatican II.
The big reformation, right? Essentially, like
busting things open, still busting things open. And it went around this thing of the individual with a conscience.
For people not familiar with Vatican II, can you just kind of explain like what that
did? Well, there was huge backlash against it, but boy, it's out there. It's just like...
What did it change?
Well, first of all, it changed the response of individual lay people. Before, it was all clerical, whatever father said, whatever the priest said, whatever the bishop said.
Right.
That's what you do. You're not doing your own thinking. You're not doing your own conscience and sorting things out. And it brought us back to the scriptures to study the gospels, go back to them, understand how they were written. And then in community, then you begin to move and to look at the suffering of the world. I was so disconnected with the suffering in my own city. When I was a holy nun, I was teaching kids and all that. But I never went to the inner city and saw what was happening to African-American people. Never saw it because I was separated. And when you are separated, like they say, like that saying in Latin America, what the eye doesn't see, the heart can't feel. And as soon as I met people in the St. Thomas Housing Project and lived among them, it opened everything up. But Vatican II gave us the tools to do that. In our religious community, with Sisters of St. Joseph, we really believed in, look, no more of this blind obedience to whatever superior says. We got to do our own thinking about this. We got to get in there and experience things. Get out there with people. And that's what changes you.
What was it like living in the pre-Vatican II time in the convent when you were kind of, you know, in that very stifled environment? I mean, I think it's hard for someone born outside of that to even understand what that would be like. And as you mentioned, it's not really in existence as much anymore. So, I mean, just it's a very basic question, but what was that like for that to be your day-to-day as an 18-year-old living in, you know, basically silence and isolation?
When what was going on in the silence, I was learning to meditate. I was learning to read, to reflect, to have times of prayer, to have a discipline in my life, carried by community. I mean, we'd go to the chapel, be up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I embraced it. I entered into that space.
Right.
And then it was all closeness to God. Everything was directly, vertically up, closeness to God. And at times I did have these experiences that can be called mystical experiences or whatever, that indeed God is close to me. And then when I got into the classroom and began to teach, the interaction with young people, you're in there with the people. And then Vatican II hits and tells us, look, as religious, you're not this super person close to God, the laity aren't. And I really made good friends with the teachers at Cabrini where I taught. And life began to open up. And it's experience. And then I went away to school. And as I tell in River of Fire, you know, basically got very, very close to a friend, to a man,
right,
priest. And then had that relationship with him for 7 years and really experienced for the first time being close to a person who was wonderful in a lot of ways. Spiritually, we matched in a lot of ways, but he began to exert a control over my life. I don't want you talking to that person. I don't want you. And I experienced, I guess, what a lot of women do experience. And he wanted to be married. He wanted to be married. So I had to make a decision.
Were you in love with him?
What?
Were you in love with him?
On one level, yeah, of course I was. Because there were a lot of attractive, really good, wonderful things about him that I loved.
What is that like? Being a nun and taking this vow of celibacy and falling in love?
Very tricky. Very tricky. What it used to be called the third way. Now he's a priest and you're a nun. Now you're going to have a close relationship, but you're not going to have sex and you're not going to get married. Third way, it was called. It's very tricky. It's very different. It was one of the toughest experiences of my life as it began to my own self was he began to be very emotionally dependent on me. He's calling me all the time to hear my voice. And then one of the things that really held me captive was, look, if we ever break apart, I can't live. I'll end it. And boy, did that ever hold me. And it was coming into that awareness. What am I afraid of? What am I afraid of? Because I'd been called to a responsibility in the community to work with the novices, the new nuns coming in. And there was no way I could keep this relationship going. By then, I was beginning to feel captured by it or, you know, controlled by it.
Do you think that it was a reflection of who he was, or just that you felt you needed to dedicate yourself to your work and your activism, and that that precluded a romantic relationship? Like, do you think those things could have existed together?
Well, you know, there's interaction between two people. So it's not, he's there and I'm here and I'm, It was, I think, the crunching point that finally brought me to the decision to break with him. And he did crash because he had a problem with alcohol too, and he crashed. Was that I couldn't hold his life together. And that my big fear was that if I broke off the relationship, he was going to commit suicide. And I was on a retreat. I was walking the beach. I still remember walking into that, like you walk in a circle of light. What's my fear? That he'll commit suicide if I break the relationship off. But the relationship is really stifling me and keeping me from being who I need to be. And they happened together. That happened together. He's a really a good man. He died 2013. He taught me a lot. I mean, you get stuff from relationships. It was gifts that he gave me as well. But it really came clear to me. I can't be married. I can't be that close to somebody and who needs me this much. He's calling all the time and then he'd get really upset if I didn't return.
That's so fascinating to me because your work now is with people who, in some sense, their spiritual needs are even deeper. I mean, you're watching them die.
And why are you comparing those two things? One is a love relationship with somebody who expects you.
I suppose I just mean in the sense of like, the weight that it might place on a person.
Well, that's different kinds of weights for sure. I mean, there are weights, of course, in this. But you know, when you're clear about your own soul, and I know, I mean, all the people, the eight people I've been with, been executed, I haven't been able to save anybody. Not that my goal is to save them. I'm going to do everything I know, which is what attracts me to your program of reasoning. To be able to, what is their case? What happened in their case? How can we get them lawyers? How can we take every step we know to save their lives? And I know that I do that. I do it with energy and dedication and see them through to the end. I know I do that. And then, I don't know, these are deep mysteries, Billy.
So when you first entered the convent, you said that the biggest threat to the world was atheistic communism. And you've since seen a lot of stuff. You were a teacher during school integration in New Orleans. You saw the KKK protesting. And you even met Martin Luther King Jr. in an airport, which is interesting.
Oh, man, he was so tired looking.
You chatted with him a bit, right?
What?
You chatted with him a bit, right?
I went up to him. I said, he was behind me in the line. And he looked so tired. And I realized afterwards when I read his life, he was just coming out of Cicero, Illinois, where people were throwing things at him in that white community there. Mm-hmm. And I just went up to him and took his hand. And I just said, Dr. King, just want you to know I admire what you're doing and I'm praying for you. He said, oh, thank you. He said, God, we need prayers, man. And that was it. Then later I read his life. But see, I wasn't out there then. I didn't participate in any of the civil rights. These good nuns you see out there in Selma and stuff. I wasn't awake. And it's a gift to be awake. Suddenly you come to a realization about stuff. And that's when you got to act.
So 1950s, biggest threat, atheistic communism in Sister Helen's mind. In 2024, in Sister Helen's mind, what is the biggest threat?
Is that we got to educate people to have a real democracy in this country, these tribal wars you're talking about now. You got to get to people. You have to talk to them. They have to help them. You write books, you get in there and you talk to them. You do movies, you do operas, you do whatever you got to do. You have a relationship with them. You can't just be on your little island. So you're doing it with a podcast and I'm doing it with books and the one I'm writing now about a man on death row for 30 years who's innocent, Manuel Ortiz. But you act. See, it's the action. And I get tired, you know, and I'm older now. I'm 85, you know, so I take more naps.
You don't look it.
Cooperate with God. Anyway, and my mama. Her skin, see, you get, it's pure genes. Because it's when you have a lot of wrinkles, you really look old. And I helped God with the white hair thing. I'd have snow white hair if I didn't have this little bottle. But I figure I'm collaborating with God.
You can drop your skincare routine on Twitter. People will be eager to have it.
I don't spend much time without that. But anyway, because I'm with the young people, see? I just was with a group at University of San Francisco, and it's a Jesuit university. And I was with a group of young people that have awakened to justice, and they're working on the Innocence Project to work for wrongfully convicted people. Boy, and you walk in that room with those young people and the energy in that room, and I know where that energy is coming from, because it's about a really big human rights issue, and they become awake to it at a young age, and they're ready to be involved. And I do believe in the goodness of people. I don't believe most people are really wedded to, we got to let the state kill people. They're just removed from it. My job is to bring them close. Said yes to you.
On that note, Sister Helen Prejean, thank you so much for talking to Reason.
Thank you. I've enjoyed every second of it. Keep doing it.